ぜひ。
Good evening. My name is Vicky. I am an alcoholic. My sobriety date, December 16th, 2009. Before I start, I just want to say you had no idea how I prayed that nobody would show up tonight. You know, all I ever wanted was to be somebody and belong somewhere. From an early, early age, I remember feeling that there was something wrong with me, that I was less than other people. I didn't understand it at the time. I wasn't a rebel as a child. I was quite compliant, actually. Looking back, I realized I was a slave to praise. How you perceived me was much more important than how I really was. On the outside, I appeared to be calm, cool, and collected. On the inside, I was a quivering mass. By the age of 28, I had been married and divorced twice and had two children. Being the consummate actress that I was, I went into a career of sales. After all, what is sales other than telling the customer what he wants to hear? And I've been doing that for a very long time. My alcoholism didn't manifest itself until I was in my mid-40s. Up until then, I could actually drink like a lady. Then gradually, over time, that occasional glass of wine became the glass of wine every night. Then two, then three, then the bottle, and many bottles after that. I was for the period of about 5 years what I think is called a heavy drinker. I drank almost every night, but I got up and went to work the next day. The reason I say I was a heavy drinker was because I did stop for periods of time. I spent most of my life trying to change situations that didn't suit me. It took me many years before I would concede to the fact that I had serious control issues. I guess that's called insight. I'm not sure. At the age of 50, I started my own business, and it was successful. I had arrived. I had the big house, a fancy car, and a thriving business. And I drank. I continued on like that for about 2 more years. I managed to conduct my business, but over time, everything that had meant something to me became meaningless. Alcohol, once my friendly companion, had turned on me, and it now owned me. I rarely drew a sober breath. I had lost the ability to control my drinking. My children were concerned watching their mother go through this downward spiral, especially my son, who had come to join me in my business a couple of years earlier. I attempted once I did admit myself to a lockdown mental facility, also known as an insane asylum, I think, to detox. Then after 4 days, they turned me loose and pronounced me cured. I went to outpatient therapy like a good person 3 times a week, and still I drank. I drank. My children's concern gradually turned to disgust. They just did not understand why I could not stop drinking. They didn't know that I no longer had that choice. it became apparent that I was not going to stop drinking, so my son set about removing me from the business. And I made it easy. In a fit of drunken rage, I signed over everything to him, lock, stock, and barrel. All I wanted to do was drink in peace. I lost my house, I lost my car, I lost my business, I lost my family. And still I could not stop drinking. Me, who had overcome every obstacle ever placed before me, had run up against the one thing that I could not overcome with sheer willpower and determination. A suicide attempt actually saved my life and sent me back to the lockdown mental facility. Because it was there that it was suggested that I go into a 30-day treatment program. I wasn't very hopeful at that point. I actually didn't think there was a solution to my problem, but I had nothing to lose, so I went. And it was in that recovery home that I was introduced to AA. Now I admit, for a person like me, who had always let their own ego and willpower direct their lives, the thought of turning my life over to a higher power, someone more powerful than I was, did not set well in the beginning. But I came into contact with women in this program who seemed to be leading happy, joyous lives, and they didn't drink, and I was intrigued. I got a sponsor, I got a big book, I started working the steps, and I learned that my problem with alcohol was just a symptom of a much bigger problem. I had a problem with life. I had to adopt a new attitude and learn to live life on the terms that it presented to me rather than as I wanted them to be. But fortunately, the steps showed me how to do that. Today, my life is very different. I don't have a big house. I don't drive a fancy car. I do have my children back in my life, though. And the business, God bless my son, is still prospering. But today I have enough. I actually have plenty. I have peace of mind and I'm happy. I've learned, and I'm learning on a daily basis, to live life on life's terms and to surrender my will to a power greater than myself. And there's one other bonus that came with all this. I found a place where I belong, right here in these rooms of AA. Thank you.
Okay, everyone, let's give a rousing Tulare County welcome for our featured speaker, Susan.
Okay, I'm trying to figure out if I should take off my glasses so I can't see you or not. I don't know. My name's Susan and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm a little scared, so my sobriety date is May 22nd, 1990, and whenever I think about that, it just totally blows me away. I can't believe it. If you'd known me when I got sober, you wouldn't believe it either. I was born at a very early age. A long time ago. Long ago. So I'm getting pretty old, so I forget things, forget words, and so I make things up as I go along. But, anyway, I was the youngest of four children, and I had alcoholic parents, and my dad died when I was like 13, and my mom died when I was 29 and a half, and they both died from alcoholism. And I can remember thinking that I didn't realize it was the alcohol. It was them being weak, bad people. And that, because I never thought, well, I'm not going to drink when I grow up because look what it does to you. I just thought that they were just bad. And it had nothing to do with the alcohol. It was about the people. And when I was 14, my sister got married. And I think there was some champagne, something at the not a rehearsal. No, at the reception. And I told you. I can remember I was her little maid of honor, and I can remember walking down the aisle, and I had these maybe 3-inch heels on because that's. Anyway, and my legs were going just like this, you know. I was just scared to death. I don't like being in front of people. And this is before I'd ever drank. But I had a couple of glasses while I was there of some kind of alcoholic beverage. And it was like, oh my gosh, all of a sudden I got really cute. I mean, I was 14. I got cute. I could talk. I was funnier than you. Oh, you wouldn't believe it. I was really funny. And it was great. And, you know, but that didn't start a whole history of drinking. I just drank that time and thought it was great. And then my sister moved out of the house. Both my brothers were gone by then. And so it was just me and my mom. And my mom worked nights at a school for girls, which I thought was pretty appropriate. She worked, I think, like 12 to 8. She would buy me and my friends beer. And Rainier Ale is something I can remember. This is really good stuff. This was in the mid-60s. And so we would drink. And sometimes I'd even take her to work. And I was 15, I think. But that didn't make any difference. I knew how to drive, so that was fine. And one morning I woke up and I was laying in bed with this boy I went to school with that I wasn't a boyfriend or anything at all, and all of a sudden I wasn't a virgin, and I was like, oh god, shit, how'd that happen, you know? And I didn't even remember it. I was like, oh. But it did cure me from drinking for a while. I decided, you know, wow, I don't like that. Because at least I didn't remember what I did or not. And so we quit doing that, and maybe I quit drinking anyway. And it might have had something to do with the fact that I think we got evicted from that apartment because I'd play music late. My mom wasn't home, so we'd do whatever we wanted to, and the neighbors didn't really care for that. So anyway, I quit drinking, but I had this little reputation. And, you know, I really didn't deserve it because I didn't do anything wrong, not in my own mind. And so that started my lying because somebody, you know, a little kid come up and say, did you and Billy, I think his name was, this starts a long line of me not remembering the guy's names I slept with. I'll tell you that. I'm not as gracious, I guess, as Vicky was. Different lifestyle. But anyway, I would said no. I know he's a liar, and no, I didn't do that, and no, and no, and no, and no, and no. And, you know, maybe I would have believed it. But anyway, I can remember this guy. I was a sophomore, and he was a senior, and he asked me out. It was like, oh, wow, how exciting. And my mom wasn't home that night. And he took me home, and he tried to take advantage of me. And luckily, I somehow stopped him. But, you know, that's pretty much what happened to girls who did that in the mid-60s because, you know, nice girls didn't do stuff like that. And I really want you to believe I was really a nice girl. At least I thought I was. You know, I wanted to be. And my mom drinking and stuff. Anyway, she quit kind of coming home. So my sister decided I should go live with her and my my brother-in-law, and I did that, and, you know, life just went on, and it was wonderful, and I met this guy, and I fell in love, and I was a junior in high school, and he was a senior, and I ended up getting pregnant, and this was in 1966, and in 1966, you didn't get pregnant and just skip down, you know, along your happy way. I was sent away to a home for unwed mothers, and it was a pretty awful time, and it changed my life, because inside, I knew I was a horrible person, and I can remember standing on our kitchen table and praying to this God that I knew was supposed to be out there, and asking, you know, if I just jump off, maybe I could have a miscarriage, and then I'd never do that again. But it didn't work. And so I had this little girl. I was 17 and a half, and a senior in high school. And, you know, in those days, what you did was you go away, and a few months later, you come back home, you pretended like nothing ever happened. And so that's what I did, only I was changed inside. The boy that was the father, he and I stayed together, and I ended up getting pregnant again, and we got married. And we used to belong to a sports car club. And, you know, it was twice a year we would have these parties, and we'd drink at these parties. And so from about the time I was 15 to when I was 18, I really didn't drink. But then it started like twice a year. And I can remember thinking, if I could only figure out which drink it was that went from me having fun and being cute and funny and all this stuff and being able to dance to being drunk. And, you know, for the rest of my life, I was looking for that damn drink. Which one was it? I could never figure it out. And because I always took that extra one. You know, I consider myself an alcoholic from the very start. Because I think when I was 14 years old, I was in a blackout. And I continued having those little blackouts throughout my adulthood. My high school sweetheart and I split up when I was 20 and a half years old. We were married for 2 whole years. And that was about par for the course for me. I moved to Bakersfield to live with my sister. And I was 20 and a half. So, you know, at 21, I finally got to go to a bar legally, and my sister and I used to drink, but we only drank on the weekends. I got a job, and you know, life was great. It was 1971 1970 72 73, and sex, drugs, and rock and roll, and you know, it was a sexual revolution, but still, you know, there's this part of this little girl in here that said, if you're going to sleep with somebody, you have to love them, because that's what I grew up hearing. I don't think it was from my parents. I think it was from, you know, Father Knows Best and all those things, because that was reality. Those shows were reality. My home life wasn't reality, and so I was in love a lot, I'll tell you, in the 70s. I fell in love about every weekend. and then one time it clicked, and he loved me back, because I ended up getting married when I was, I think it was in 73, so I was 24. And we were married for about 2 years. And in that time, he and I moved to Fresno. and I was working, and we split up, and then I met this guy at work. Oh my gosh, and I fell in love again. And this guy, before that, you know, I drank a little beer on weekends, we'd smoke a little dope because that's what we did, and you know, these little recreational drugs that were popular in the 70s. But this guy was drinking, he drank wine. And he drank wine every single day. And so I started drinking wine. I mean, if you're with somebody, you want to do what they're doing, right? And so I don't know that I never drank wine before. And this was red wine, and it was... But, and you know, it was really gross. But I acquired a taste for it. You know, and it turned out it wasn't quite so bad. Especially after a couple of drinks, you know, a couple of glasses, what the hell? Anyway, by the time I was 30 years old, I had been married and divorced 3 times. And so I knew what the problem was. It was those jerks. I had a good job. I was a single mother. I still drank every day. Even though I wasn't with this guy, I continued to drink every day. Beer, wine, you know, whatever. But I got up and went to work also every day on Mondays or Friday, and weekends, of course, I didn't. But, you know, I considered myself a functioning, well, now I'd say functioning alcoholic, but, you know, I wasn't. I didn't really have a problem. My sister and I would say, oh, yeah, because she was my drinking partner at times, we're alcoholics. But not knowing what that meant. Alcoholic, at the time, to me, that meant that you drink a lot. Yeah, okay, so we drink a lot. I went to work every day. I couldn't have a problem. Because my parents had both gotten fired from jobs because of their drinking. And you know what? I was a really good employee. I got raises. I got promotions. I might have helped that I was having an affair with my boss. I don't know. Well, probably not, because, you know, and the fact that he was married, you know, and it wasn't to me. The longest relationship of my adult life was with a married man, and it wasn't married to me. But anyway, you know, and this gets to be towards the end of the 80s, and towards the end of the 80s, my life was really spiraling, totally out of control. I was doing, snorting that little stuff, and, you know, I had a couple of DUIs by then. In 1980, I had one driving down 99. I'd almost made it to Ashland, which was my exit. And I'd been in Kingsbury all day drinking beer and smoking pot. And I was driving about 30 miles an hour on the freeway. And for some reason, they stopped me. And I got hauled off to jail, and it was a horrible, horrible experience. I cried. I was, oh, my God, never again. You know, I was filled with shame. In 1988, when I got my second one, I had been doing the lines of coke and drinking, and I was going down the highway about, 70 miles an hour, and almost sideswiped a highway patrolman. And they don't look kindly on you. When they stop you, they're not very nice. And they weren't very nice, and they kind of threw me in the back seat. The difference between Susan in 1980 and 1988 was when I got to that jail, my mouth was just rolling. I was cussing, and I hear these guys over on the other side of the drunk tank, they're cussing, and I'm cussing back to them. And I was a different person. And that's what 8 years of drinking did to me. It just ate me away inside. And for the next 2 years, it got worse and worse and worse. And finally, in February of 1990, I was in outside sales for the steel company that I worked for. And, you know, outside sales is a pretty good job to have when you're an alcoholic, because you don't go to work, they don't know. The office was in Fresno. I lived in Stockton, and Sometimes I drink a little bit too much and call on people. Sometimes I drink a little bit too much and sit out beside it in a park, around a park, and I'd read because that was my thing. I escaped by reading. And anyway, I finally told my employer that I needed help. And you know, they didn't ask me what I needed help with. They should know. And so they found me in this treatment center in Stockton called Parkside. And I went there, and it was a 28-day program. And you know, I remember going in there with my book, and the lady tried to take it from me. No, no. She said, "You're not going to have time to read that." And oh, yeah, you know, you can't take my book. And they took my book. But, and you know, I passed that treatment center course with flying colors because I know how to fit in, and I know how to make people like me, and I know how to say yes and how to hide all these feelings inside because I've been doing it all my life. You know, in my head I could kill you, and outside, and, you know, and I'm smiling. And so I went to the treatment center, I got out, I signed this paper that said if I ever drink during business hours, they can fire me. Because I knew that wasn't going to happen. I wasn't drinking anymore. You know, and so I went to meetings pretty much every day. And I got this woman that was like a temporary sponsor. And, you know, I can remember going to those meetings. And I was at a Saturday meeting, and this guy called on me, the secretary, because he didn't recognize me. And he asked for any newcomers. I didn't raise my hand because I'd been to more than three meetings. Anybody within the first 30 days, I didn't raise my hand because I had, I don't know, probably 45 days by that time. And so he said, "Well, how about you?" And I said, "Well, my name's Susan. I'm an alcoholic. I'm sober today and doing fine. I was dying lousy inside. But I knew if I told you who I was, that you'd all get up and leave because you couldn't believe the horrible person that I was." That's what I thought. I thought I was the worst there ever was, and that nobody had done the things that I'd done, you know, the lying, the cheating, the stealing, the sleeping around. And one of the big things was the fact that I had a child when I was in high school and I gave her up for adoption. You know, that was something that stayed with me my whole life. And I'd get drunk and cry and do all this. You know, it was, I was a real, real happy drunk a lot of the time. You really wanted to be around me if I got in one of my depressive times. You know, I was like, oh yeah. It was either one or the other. I was either really happy and having a great time, or I was down in the dumps and having a horrible time. Sometimes I think about me and my girlfriend sitting around the table singing Linda Ronstadt, "Silver Threads," the top of our lungs. Oh my God! And I don't have a very good singing voice, but I'd like to show you if you want to hear it. Anyway, back to 1990. At about 60 days sober, I got a 60-day chip, and I was seeing this guy that lived up in Hayward. I was living in Stockton, and I went up to his place and stopped and got me some little wine coolers and went to his place and started drinking again. And, you know, I don't know that I ever thought that I was going to control it and they weren't going to find out, but within 2 weeks, the boss said he wanted to meet me, and so we were going to meet in Lodi, and I showed up, I think I was an hour late, and I was in a blackout most of the drive down from Hayward, and drunk, and so, you know, he wanted to get a pee test to make sure that I really was drunk, even though I was obviously drunk. So we went to the treatment center, and we got there, and he told them that he wanted them to test me. Well, they couldn't test urine for alcohol. They only tested for drugs. So I guess he just figured that he was gonna fire me. So they fired me. And it was the worst thing that ever happened in my whole life, I thought. And I thought, you know what, I'd worked with them for 12 years. Why couldn't they give me a break? Give me another chance. But they hadn't given me enough. So I got fired and went on about a week run. And the part in the big book where it says, incomprehensible demoralization, pitiful incomprehensible demoralization. The last weekend I drank, that was me. I never ever want to be in that spot again. I hope I never forget exactly how I felt, and that's one of the reasons that I go to meetings today, is to listen to people that maybe have gone out or talk about how they felt when they came in, so I can remember how I felt. I don't want to start believing what my head's telling me, that maybe it wasn't so bad. All I have to do is remember that last weekend that I was drinking, and the last night that I was sitting in my car, Kmart parking lot, trying to figure out how I was going to kill myself. And both my parents had committed suicide, so I couldn't do that to my daughter. And I think my mom killing herself is what kept me alive, because I just couldn't do it. And so I called the treatment center again, and they asked me how long I'd been sober that time. And I had to be 3 days or else something. I don't know if they wouldn't have talked to me or they would have put me in a detox or something. So I lied. You know, I started my sobriety lying. What the hell? And I went to and talked to one of the counselors there, and they told me that I needed to go to a halfway house. And I said, okay. And so then they told me that I needed to call and try and get into a halfway house. And so I said, okay. And if you would ask the Susan that got out of that treatment center the end of February, but it was now May, she wouldn't have done that. But I called, there's like 3 houses for women in Stockton, and you had to have 30 days sobriety in order to live at these halfway houses, so I couldn't. But I think it was the act of trying that I was willing to go to any length to stay sober. I did not want to feel how I felt anymore. And, you know, I'd had a little bit of something when those 60 days I was sober. But the thing I realized is, in step one, you know, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable. I do believe that I knew I was powerless over alcohol. But my life wasn't unmanageable. I mean, I had a job, I had my apartment, I had a car, I had all this stuff. So what's unmanageable about that? I didn't look at the fact that I was late on my rent. My car payment, I paid my utilities by the 48-hour notice plan. And I knew they were serious when they sent me those little envelopes with the red, and so I'd do something about it. But finally, after I got fired, I realized that my life was totally unmanageable, and it had been unmanageable even before then. And so I started to go to meetings, and I started sharing, and I got a sponsor. And, you know, I started working the steps, and to be able to tell you who I was, and I can remember talking. If somebody called on me or if I had something, you know, whatever, I was talking, I would talk really fast so I could hurry up and get it out. And then I'd get lightheaded. And I didn't know why I was getting lightheaded. And one time I was talking real fast, trying to get it all out, tell you guys exactly what it was about me and how awful I was, but I was getting better. And my sponsor said, "Susan, breathe." Okay. Maybe I was causing lightheadedness. I don't know. But life started getting better. I found another job, and I was going to meetings. I was doing the deal, and even though I had got evicted from that apartment that I was laid on, and I went to court and I said, "Hey, wait," I talked to this guy, and so it turned out okay, even though I had to move. And I moved in with my sponsor, and I lived with her and her husband for 6 months. And, life was good. And I celebrated a year. And in Stockton in those days, all the birthday people sat up in front of the room, and there were probably 10 of us celebrating. And I stood up, and my name's Susan, and I just started crying because I couldn't believe that I'd had a year of sobriety. I mean, it was like the biggest miracle in my whole life. It was amazing. And so I was crying, and then because it embarrassed me to cry in front of people, I was laughing because that's what I do when I'm nervous. I laugh a lot. And my nose is running, so I'm laughing and I'm crying. And I said, I made an impression on all those people at that meeting. But nobody wanted to hold my hand. It's my brother. And after that year, my sponsor said, "Okay, the first year is yours, and now you got to start paying back." And she let me know how important it was to be there for other people, to go to meetings, because what if nobody had been at a meeting when I first came in? She let me know that it was my responsibility to give back and to be there for the newcomers or for anybody that is suffering today. You don't have to be a newcomer. You can have sobriety. There's people kill themselves probably every day, and they might be sober, but they're not happy, and they're dying lousy, and I don't want to be that person, and I don't want to sit at home watching TV one day when I could be at a meeting and maybe help somebody. I'm not that I think I'm all powerful, but I think each of us in our own way is responsible to Alcoholics Anonymous. I mean, Alcoholics Anonymous saved my life, and I'll never ever be able to repay what I have been given freely. And it's when I was 2 years sober, my sponsor, she said, "Do you think you're a little depressed?" And I'm thinking, "No, I can't be depressed. I've had depression before I got sober." And always then it was, I didn't eat, I lost a lot of weight, and this time I was eating. I can't be depressed because I still have an appetite. And I was like, okay. So one day I woke up and I started crying, and I couldn't stop crying. And I was a little over 2 years sober. And luckily at that time I lived across the street from her. And her husband was going to a meeting, and I said, he ran and caught her and dragged her out of bed, and I went over there, and I ended up going to a mental hospital. See, I didn't do this when I was drinking. I waited until I got sober, and then I went into a mental hospital. I went in on a Friday, and they told me that I was probably going to have to be there for 3 weeks. And on that Saturday, they only have a skeleton crew, and so this woman, one of the counselors there, she could see that there was something bothering me, and so I started talking about the baby that I had given up for adoption and how there was this hole in my gut, and I didn't know if she was alive or dead, and I just, that had always bothered me. And she said, "Well, the same thing had happened to her. And this is how, what she had done. She contacted the place that she rent, and so she said, I could probably do something like that. And this was on Saturday. On Monday, the place found out how much my insurance covered, and so they told me I was going to be released that Monday. Yeah, this is a miracle cure. But what I firmly believe that what this did, I saw the person that I was supposed to see on Saturday, and about a week later I had written the name of the house that I was at, Florence Crittenden, Home for Unwed Mothers. That sounds so stupid today, but a friend came over and said, what's that for? And I told her, you know, I was going to try and call his home. She said, oh no, you call the county. So I called Ventura County, which is where I'd live. And I got switched. I must have told this story, I don't know how many times that day, and I get switched to here, and I get switched to here, and I get switched to there. And finally I got switched to this woman, and she said, oh yes, and didn't you marry the boy later? She was my worker in 1967 when I had my daughter. And this was in 1993. My same worker. And she wouldn't have been, a week later she was leaving. She was changing departments. And she said that the daughter that I had given up for adoption had at one time signed a release. And within a week, because I had to sign this paper and get it notarized. Within a week, I talked to my daughter on the telephone. And she lived in Ventura. And after I talked to her that first time, I used to do this newcomers meeting three days a week. And, you know, I went to the meeting, even though I was a bundle owner. And there were no newcomers there, but there were a couple of other people there. And I sat and I cried and I talked about what this meant to me for that hour. And then I met her a couple of days later. And, you know, I was all worried about telling her that I was an alcoholic. And the lady, whatever she was, the woman that I talked to at the county said that she didn't think that was going to be a problem because my daughter, whose name was Karen, her husband is in the fellowship, and he has about 9 months more sober than me. So she was very familiar with Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have to worry about it. And I tell you what, you know, I don't think that happened because of what a wonderful person I am. That was God working in my life. You know, that was one of the miracles that, you know, it's unbelievable. And I had this dream before I met Karen. I had this dream of, I don't know if you guys remember the commercial of these two people running together through flowers. And this was me and her, only she was a baby. I couldn't look at her as anything other than a baby. That's what I remembered. And you know, we don't have the relationship that I would have wanted or I thought I wanted, but we have a relationship today. I do believe she has the disease that I passed on, but it's none of my business. And I, you know, when I think about that, I get chilled, and I can't believe it happened to me. Because one of the things I remember saying is, things like this don't happen to people like me. You know, I guess I didn't think good things happen to people like me. But, you know, when I got sober, good things started happening to people like me. And I saw it happening to all kinds of other people. And when I was 9 months sober, I was going to have to move out of my sponsor's place, you know, grow up, cut the apron strings. And I thought, you know, there's nobody that's going to want to rent to me with my background, my history of financial misdeeds. And I went and talked to this lady, and I explained to her, I said, you're going to see about 9 months ago that my bill-paying ability got a lot better. And I told her that I'd gotten sober. And she was willing. When she told me that I got the apartment and that I was going to sign this rental agreement, she gave me this little plaque that said, Lord, help me to remember that nothing will happen today that you and I can't get out of together. It's something like that. I still have it. Obviously, I don't read it well. You know, one thing good, fine. You know. But then after about a year, I finally decided that maybe I could date. And so this guy picked me. He had like 12 years sober, and here I was with a year, and I was no longer a newcomer, you know, because I had over a year. But it didn't work out. We moved in together, which was pretty much my MO, you know. You meet somebody, you sleep with them, you move in together, and then you find out, shit, I don't even like this guy. So, anyway, we moved in together, and I told my father, I said, oh, shit, it's not working. And I didn't know what I was going to do. I figured either I was going to have to drink or he was going to have to die. That's the only way I was going to be able to break up with him. But I didn't drink, and he didn't die, and he moved out, and, you know, it's... All those things have helped me to learn and to have, I was told, how can I have self-esteem if I don't do esteemable things? And so I started out paying my bills and doing things like that and not screwing everybody I came into contact with. And not that I did that anyway, but kind of close. Now, you know, I knew I couldn't do the things in sobriety that I had done when I was drinking, or else I wasn't going to be able to stay sober. And, you know, that, I don't think it was because of anything wonderful on my part that I didn't do a lot of things. It's just I didn't want to experience the bad feelings. I didn't want to not like myself anymore. I was trying to do things to feel better about myself. And they told me, well, you look in the mirror and you say, I love you, Susan. And so I did that for a few months. And then I realized, you know, I was looking at my hair. I was looking at the wall behind me in the mirror. I wasn't looking at myself. Because I really didn't believe it. It took me a while to believe that I deserved anything good in my life. I told my sponsor that I really didn't think that there was that God. You know, I was alone because I was too bad for God to love me. And she said that I was one of God's kids, and God doesn't make junk. And it's little things like that. And she gave me unconditional love. When I did my first step, my fifth step with her, and talked to her about other things, but she told me, you know, if you feel like you're going to drink because of something that in your past, don't wait until you're ready to share it in a fourth and fifth step. You tell me now. And one of the things was stealing. I stole from my employer. And I thought I was the only one that ever did that. You know, and she told me her experience. And, you know, it's just... Alcoholics Anonymous has changed my life. Well, I'll tell you for one thing, I got married in 1997, and I've been married to the same man just 16 years, and I have... and I have not slept with anybody other than my husband in all that time. And, you know, that's pretty damn good. No, and you know, I finally found out that it wasn't those jerks picking me, it was me picking those jerks, and that if I wanted something different, I had to become a different person so that I wouldn't attract those kind of people. And not sure if I did the right thing. No. Now, you know, I married a really nice man, and sometimes he might be too nice for me, but that's his problem. He knew I was going to have to give him a bad time up here. But I don't know. I'm sorry, Rick. I think I'm going to end up a little bit sooner than you're saying, please just stop now. Anyway, Rick, thank you very much for asking me. And Vicki, thank you for getting out of your comfort zone and sharing your experience, strength, and hope with us. And also thank you for the dinner. And thank everybody here for their support. You know, I don't think I had any friends when I came into Alcoholics Anonymous. And today, I can't imagine what my life would be like without the friends I have in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the unconditional love that I have found here. Because I tell you, I could call anybody and say, hey, I need some help. I might drink or whatever. And I wouldn't have to worry about it. There would be people there. I can't tell you how grateful I am to all of you here and how grateful I am to Alcoholics Anonymous. And thank you very much.
Thank you.